abandon free market principles to save the free market system.
In a world of conventional confusion,
There will be time for them to make profits. Now's not that time.
Daddy, what do taxes pay for?
Oh, why everything. Policemen, trees, sunshine. And let's not forget the folks who just don't feel like working, God bless them.
Don't be afraid of your freedom.
Prepare to unshackle your mind.
An idea whose time has come cannot be stopped by any army or any government.
Your professor has arrived. Tom Woods. Beware, citizen. You are now departing from the world of allowable opinion. The Tom Woods Show.
Welcome, everybody. It is Friday, November 8th, 2013. Tom Woods here, joined by Tom DiLorenzo in just a few minutes. But a couple quick announcements first. Remember, this coming Monday, November 11th, I'll be at Miami University in Ohio. That event is taking place at 7 p.m. in Taylor Auditorium at the Farmer School of Business. So I hope you guys can make it, those of you in the Cincinnati area. And then remember, I've got an insane schedule. November 18th, Clarion University. November 19th, Penn State. And November 20th, two events. One at St. Louis University School of Law and the other one at Lindenwood University. That one is in St. Charles, Missouri. We got details about these events up at tomwoods.com/events. And if logistical details are not up yet, they will be soon. So please stay tuned. Next week, we got some great programming for you next week. We're going to have a foreign policy update with Daniel McAdams of the Ron Paul Institute. We're going to talk to Bob Murphy, and I'm going to have him, he doesn't know this yet, I'm going to have him talk about modern monetary theory. If you haven't heard about this, you probably will, and you're going to want to know how to answer it. And Bob will equip you, will devote the whole program to explaining what MMT is and what the proper response to it is. And I got other guests lined up for next week. It's going to be great. I'm going to be taking one of the programs solo and just talking about deflation. Remember the alleged problem of prices falling, like we can't have that. So I'm going to talk about the real story about deflation in a program that I'm going to do on my own. So I hope you can join me for that next week. And remember, subscribe to the show. Help us stay up there on the charts at iTunes and Stitcher. And you can use the archive at tomwoodsradio.com. We broadcast the show every day live, sort of live, like we broadcast it anyway, at noon Eastern at tomwoodsradio.com. And then you can get the program downloadable as a podcast and everything else a little bit later on. But right now, let's turn our attention to Tom DiLorenzo. Many of you know Tom. He is the author of a great many books, at least a dozen, I would say. The Real Lincoln is the most notorious, but he's also the author of How Capitalism Saved America, Lincoln Unmasked, Hamilton's Curse, and Organized Crime, The Unvarnished Truth About Government. Tom is a professor of economics at the business school at Loyola University in Maryland, and I'm always glad to have a chance to talk to him. Tom DiLorenzo, welcome to the program.
Pleased to be with you, Tom.
Well, as 2013 slips away, so do our opportunities to reflect on the centenary of three hideous institutions, and that, of course, is those would be the Federal Reserve System, the income tax, and the direct election of senators, all of which we date back to the momentous year 1913. You gave a talk at the Mises Institute one year on what you called the Revolution of 1913. I thought that would make a good topic, as here we are in November 2013. We can look back on 100 years of glorious revolution and talk about what the consequences have been. So let's go one at a time here. I think the one that would be most obvious for people, because maybe for a lot of people it's not so obvious what the Federal Reserve does or why the direct election of senators really matters, but the income tax, more or less everybody feels the pinch of that. So let's start there. Where did that all come from? Why was there pressure to have an income tax? Weren't people happy being relatively lightly taxed?
Well, there was the first federal income tax was during the war to prevent Southern independence, as I call it, during the Lincoln administration. Then that was ended in 1872, but I think it gave the statists sort of a taste of what could be. You know, they kind of liked having this big giant pot of money. Even, you know, the war was over in 1865, but still for another 6 or 7 years they had all that income tax revenue to play with and to buy votes with. And so there was periodically, I think there were dozens of attempts to resurrect the income tax. And we almost did get it during the Grover Cleveland years in the 1880s. But then we finally got it in 1913, the fateful year. And one of the important contributing factors was the high protectionist tariffs that were the policy of the Republican Party from the Lincoln administration all the way up until 1913 really disproportionately harmed farmers more than anybody, because everybody had to pay higher prices for things that these tariff taxes are imposed on. But at the same time, what a tariff does, which is basically a sales tax on imports, is it impoverishes our trading partners. So if people from England cannot sell things in America, well, they do not have the dollars with which to buy things from America. And what were they buying from Americans? Mostly food, mostly agricultural products. So farmers are always hit twice by protectionism. Once, they have to pay the same high prices for clothing and things that we all have to pay higher prices for. And then their business drives up. They're farmed overseas. And in the late 19th century, they were, their overseas business in the southern states was about still about 60 to 70% of their whole business. And so the farm block, the farmers of the country became an important voting block for an income tax, because they were promised, we will take the pressure off you. We will reduce the tariff rate if you, the farmers, organize support for an income tax, which they did. And we were still a very much more of an agricultural economy, certainly, than we are today. And so there was a lot of votes and a lot of money involved in the farm vote. And then, of course, they bait and switched them. It's, right after we got the income tax, the Ford and the McCumber tariff came in several years later and increased the tariff rate back up from around 20% or 22% to 30, I think it was 39%. And then by the time you get to 1930, we had the Smoot-Hawley tariff, which was almost 60% on average. And so we ended up with extremely high income tax rates after World War One, and a high tariff rate again.
Well, in a way, not that I would support any tax, but I almost feel like saying they got what they deserved, because in supporting the income tax, they weren't supporting a tax that they themselves ever expected to be paying. They imagined that some other schmuck who was richer than they were was going to be fleeced, and they'd be off the hook. So in a way, in a certain poetic justice kind of sense, they got what they deserve. But nobody deserves a tax, I suppose. But what is it about the income tax that makes it any worse than any other kind of tax? Aren't all taxes oppressive? Like, is there something uniquely bad about the income tax?
Well, it punishes work, for one thing. It's a tax on work effort and saving and investing, for one thing. And then also, the income tax, you know, since it's so pervasive, it's on everybody who earns income, it gives the government so much money. One of the things I wrote about, you know, I have a whole chapter on the Revolution of 1913 in my book, Hamilton's Curse. And I quoted some of the old right authors who were writing about it at the time, like Felix Morley, for example. And they made the point that, you know, during the Lincoln administration, even though he had a sort of a primitive income tax and they had conscription, the government still did not have enough money really to enforce conscription very well. But once you got the federal income tax in 1913, and the draft for World War One, well, then you could enforce conscription. You have the means to hire thousands or tens of thousands of conscription police to go and hunt down people who might try to avoid it. And so that's one of the insidious things about the income tax. And also, it led to a tremendous centralization of power in Washington, D.C. You know, the original Constitution of America did not give any taxing power to the federal government at all, income or anything else. The states raised all the tax money. And so the income tax did exactly the opposite. It was sort of one of the final nails in the coffin of limited decentralized government in the Jeffersonian tradition, because it gave the government all that money. And you combine that with the Fed, and that's how they financed the entry into World War One.
So the consequences of the income tax then are not hard, I think, for the average person to get. But I think it is harder for people to understand why it should matter to us what happened with the 17th Amendment, which involved the direct election of senators. So first of all, how did senators used to be elected? And what difference does it make that they changed the manner of electing senators with the 17th Amendment?
Okay, under the original Constitution, United States senators were appointed by state legislatures. And the purpose of that was so that the people back home, who they were supposed to represent, could have at least some sort of control over their behavior. The founders understood the danger of a representative, a senator, going to the nation's capital and then being influenced by lobbyists rather than the people back home. And this was long before the word lobbyist even existed. And for example, when Andrew Jackson confronted the Bank of the United States, and he eventually defunded the Bank of the United States, which was a precursor of the Fed, there were seven senators who were appointed by their legislatures who went to Washington under the promise that they would support Andrew Jackson and oppose the Bank of the United States. But then once they got to Washington, they were easily bribed and bought off by the Bank of the United States. And so, and they were all recalled by their legislators back home and fired. There was none of this waiting for 5.5 years until the next senatorial election or anything like that. They were fired or forced to resign, is what happened. And that was the idea. That's why it was useful to have senators, or important to have senators, appointed by the state legislatures. It wasn't a perfect system, of course. All politics is corrupt. But when we adopted the 17th Amendment in 1913, that led to the direct election of senators, then, well, that created the system that we have now where they can go and raise money for the senator from Kansas can go to China and raise money from Chinese businessmen to finance his reelection campaign, or anywhere on the planet for that matter. And so, and that's exactly what the founding fathers feared, and that's exactly what has happened.
But let's take a concrete example like your state of Maryland, where you live. Would it really make much of a difference if the legislators of Maryland chose the senators as opposed to the voters in Maryland at large? I mean, wouldn't they be equally crummy?
Equally crummy, yeah. Well, I think the main argument that the founders made was that it would be convenient for the legislators to simply fire a senator on the spot. Just, you reneged on your promise to support Andrew Jackson. You're out of here. We're going to send somebody else. Whereas if you have to rely on direct elections, we have the election laws. You have to wait for 5 years for the next election, and in that time, the misbehaving senator could raise tons of money from all his lobbyist special interest supporters to defeat the thing and keep his job. And I think, I don't know if the founders ever made that particular argument, but I think that's what the sort of thing they had in mind.
Do you think the 17th Amendment was introduced because the elites in the United States were deeply concerned that democracy was being thwarted under the old system?
Yeah, that was the basic argument. The god of democracy needed to be supported. And there was a crusade that lasted for decades to do this. It was, from my reading of the history, there were attempts to have direct election of senators for many decades prior to 1913. And, of course, this was the Progressive Era. And so under the Progressive Era, democracy became a god with a small g, and that held the day, and that's how we got it.
Well, the third of these ingredients is maybe the most important because the least understood and the least talked about, and that's the Federal Reserve System. When I was in school, we didn't learn anything about the Federal Reserve System. It wasn't even mentioned, right? And of course, in an economics course, even in college, you'll learn about it, but only in a technical sense. Here's how it works. Here's what it does. Here's why we need it. Never really a dispassionate an overview or analysis. So when the Fed was created in 1913, was that an example? Here I am trying to find some evidence that our overlords are just looking out for what's good for us. Is there any evidence that there was any attempt on the part of policymakers or bankers to try to foster the common good by giving us a stable currency that would be overseen by a central bank and so on?
No, that's another one of the sort of the curses of the progressive era was this idea that government regulation is in the public interest. The founding generation, of course, would be horrified that this was this sort of a widely accepted idea that government acts in the public interest. You know, we went from James Madison's warning that men are not angels. That's why we needed a constitution, because, you know, angels were never be in charge of government, to this idea that, well, yeah, men are angels if they're in politics, and so they serve the public interest. And so I guess if you repeat that enough in the schools and in the culture, you get a majority of the people to believe in that line, you can get away with all these things. But, you know, there's a long history of research in economics on what's called the capture theory of regulation, and it's an understanding that regulatory agencies that were created in the early 20th century were, with very few exceptions, if any exceptions, they're all basically either lobbied for by big business interests in the first place, or if they weren't lobbied for them very much, they were eventually captured by big business and worked for big business. But somehow the Fed seems to have escaped that. Even the famous Chicago School of economics never really seriously looked into that, the idea of the Fed being a special interest. But, you know, I sponsored a lecture at my university a couple of nights ago by a man who has been in the banking business for 40 years. He's the CEO of a major banking corporation in America, one of the top 10 financial institutions. And he said of the Fed, somebody asked him, why do we have a Fed? From the audience. And he said, well, the Fed was created to bail out the New York banks. And he said, that's why the New York Fed is still, for some reason, you know, the most important, most powerful of all the Fed banks, of all the divisions of the Fed. And of course, look at what happened after the Great Recession of 2007. The first thing they did was pour hundreds of billions of dollars back into what the New York banks. And that's always been the story. They call it the Fed lender of last resort, but it's sort of the bailout Santa Claus of last resort for mostly the Wall Street New York banks. And even when the Fed goes about its daily operations, open market purchases, it has established this really cozy relationship with mostly New York investment bankers like Goldman Sachs, who market the government's bonds and who make just billions of dollars doing this. And so that's sort of the racket. So the New Yorkers, they get the money first, and when the Fed creates price inflation, by the time you and I see any of this expansion of the money supply, the prices that we have to pay for everything are all gone up, and all we do is pay more for gas and clothing and groceries. But the New York investment banking community, they're the ones who really profit the most from the whole thing. Just like other examples in American history, the Civil Aeronautics Board was a cartel operation that benefited the airline industry for 50 years. The Interstate Commerce Commission benefited the trucking industry by enforcing a cartel for the trucking industry. And the Fed is a cartel enforcement mechanism for an element of the banking industry.
Now, if that's the case, though, how does government itself benefit from this? Government doesn't usually just shower benefits on people. It wants something in return. What's it getting?
I don't know. Well, it gets an expansion of the money supply. It's every politician's dream is to have a legal counterfeiting operation that only he can operate. You and I can't do it. We can go to prison for it. But the politicians have a legal counterfeiting operation that they can use to buy votes. It's illegal, of course, to walk up to a voter on the street and say, here's $50, vote for me tomorrow, although that happens. But it is legal for people to say, here's a $50,000 a year job by the government. Vote for me and get all your relatives to vote for me, financed by the Fed, by the way. And so it's a way of offering the people something for nothing, and that really is the business of politics in a democracy, isn't it?
But, again, I'll try to be the opposite of the cynic here just to play devil's advocate. I mean, don't we need an institution like the Fed to give us well, I'm trying to say this without laughing, but give us economic stability?
The answer is no. The monetary economist George Selgin, who's an Austrian school economist, has a very good speech that's on the webs on YouTube. He's given it on several occasions. And he also has several academic journal articles. I think one of them is in the Journal of Money and Banking. and it's on 100 years of failure of the Fed. He looks in a very scholarly way at the promises that the supporters of the Fed make, that it produces price stability, economic stability in general, and it lowers unemployment. And he found that on every score, the opposite is true, that after the Fed, we had worse business cycles. And on the price stability front, you know, we do have some statistics on prices that go back several hundred years. There's a publication called Historical Statistics of the United States that economic researchers use, and it shows that the price level, the CPI, if you will, was basically the same in 1913 as it was in 1789, the year the Constitution was ratified. But since then, since 1913, it's gone up by more than 20 times. And so it's really a sort of a ridiculous joke to talk about the Fed as conducive to price stability. And even Professor Romer from UC Berkeley, who was an Obama administration economist, one of the things she is known for in her academic research is showing that the Fed actually made business cycles more unstable compared to the monetary system that existed from the end of the Civil War until we got the Fed. Christina Romer is who I'm talking about.
So we put this all together then. We put together the 16th Amendment, the 17th Amendment, and the Federal Reserve, and the result is much more centralized government with far greater powers. Well, the question that you must get on the radio an awful lot is there any scenario that you can envision that involves the reversal of any of this?
Well, you know, the Fed and the income tax gives the federal government so much power with so much money, and then the 17th Amendment is just one of the many tools that Congress uses to make it almost impossible to unseat an incumbent. That, along with gerrymandering, means that is the main reasons why we have this situation where, for about the past 50 years, the average reelection rate is 80 to 90% at minimum in the Senate, and even higher in the House of Representatives. And so that's not likely to happen, and which is why for many years I've been saying the only real hope is secession. You know, the only real hope is if peaceful secession, which is the way in which the Soviet republics escaped the clutches of the Soviet Union. And if that can never happen in the United States, then I really don't see any way out of it apart from an utter collapse of the dollar and of the economy, and then a fundamental change in the chaos of all of that. But peaceful secession would be a much preferred scenario, in my view.
Tom, before I let you go, I want to jump back for just one second into the income tax and ask you a common sort of question, which is, if you could get rid of the income tax and replace it with a national sales tax, do you think there are any advantages to that? Is it less oppressive? Is it less economically damaging? Or is this just like rearranging deck chairs on the Titanic?
No, it's rearranging deck chairs on the deck of the Titanic. The so-called national sales tax ends up being a tax on income also. And so there's really very, very little difference. And, you know, when Ron Paul was running for president the first time, he said this a lot. I don't know, the second time I didn't hear him say it as much, but he said he was in favor of eliminating the income tax and replacing it with nothing. And if you did that, the amount of money the government would have would be about what it had in 1997, which is true. I remember looking up the statistics myself, and that was exactly correct. And, of course, government was already grossly overbloated and the big majority of what it was doing was grossly unconstitutional in 1997. And so that would be the preferred scenario, get rid of the income tax and replace it with nothing. And because this idea of revenue neutrality, whenever a politician in Washington mentions tax reform, they always bring up this word revenue neutrality, so that, you know, if you or I lose our job or we get a pay cut, well, we do it. We just bite the bullet, Tom, and we do that. But not under any circumstances should government ever, ever, under any circumstance, take in a penny less, is the idea of the Washington establishment. And if people believe in that, then we really are doomed. And because every dollar the government spends, you know, impoverishes us by a dollar.
Well, Tom DiLorenzo, I'm grateful for your time, but even more so for your books, which have had a great influence on me and on many Americans. There are so many kids who have read The Real Lincoln, and more need to read books like Hamilton's Curse, which basically tells the whole history of the U.S., except with the so-called heroes as the villains and vice versa. That's my kind of history. So, Tom DiLorenzo, thanks so much again for being here today.
Thanks, Tom. Have a good day.
All right, that's it for our conversation with Tom DiLorenzo. My thanks to Tom and to you guys, as always, for listening. Remember, I gladly accept guest suggestions. It doesn't mean I'm going to take the suggestion, but I will consider them, and I appreciate those being submitted to me. And you can submit those to me at my personal site. My personal site is just tomwoods.com. That's how you can reach me. I can't necessarily answer you. I got four kids with a fifth on the way. I got 550 Ron Paul homeschool videos to do. I got emails coming out my ears, but everything you send me is gratefully received. I have about 17 copies left of Nullification, my book, and I am not giving away Nullification ever again as a giveaway. I've decided that's it. This is your last chance. If you want a free copy of Nullification signed and personalized to you, then hurry up and join my libertyclassroom.com. And you can use coupon code SHOW, if you like, in all caps. And you get a free book if you just write to me after you've signed up. Write to me on the contact page at libertyclassroom.com and say, hey, you bum, I just signed up. Here's my address. Where's my book? And we'll get that right out to you. All right, next week, we're going to start talking about foreign policy again, because these dastardly people with Obamacare in the news, they're always trying to get away with something behind our back. So we're going to keep an eye on that next week. All right, lots of great stuff coming your way next week. Thanks so much for listening, you guys. I sure appreciate it. I hope you're finding this program worthwhile, because I sure am enjoying producing it for you guys. All right, enjoy your weekend, everybody. See you on Monday.
The Tom Woods Show.